Good evening. My name is Niall Behan. I'm the Chief Executive of the Irish Family Planning Association. You're all very welcome here to our winter seminar, Developing a Women-Centred Approach to Healthcare in Post-Repeal Ireland. The IFPA receives thousands of calls through our pregnancy helpline every year, and hundreds of women attend our medical and counselling services every year. From these services, we know that Ireland's abortion laws are completely unworkable, and some would say a shambles. Women's health continues to be put at risk, by the necessity of having to travel to usually to England for abortion services. With the work of the Citizens' Assembly ongoing, the question, of what could come after the repeal of the 8th is really pertinent at this time. For the IFPA, it's vital that the voice of medical experts is heard in this debate so we can draw on the highest standards of reproductive care for women, including safe abortion services, and that we develop a framework that ensures that women's health and dignity is respected, and that healthcare providers are supported in providing women with rights-based care. I'm delighted that Maeve Taylor and her team have put together an eminent panel of speakers here this evening. Professor Arul Kumaran has been very important in bringing the international best practice analysis to Ireland's debate on reproductive health care through the Savita Halappanarvar inquiry. Professor Rebecca Cook is a longtime friend of the IFPA, even going back as far as the McGee case that the IFPA supported around contraception in the 1970s. And the IFPA's medical director, Katrina Henschen, is here to speak as well. And Katrina, through our services, hears the stories of women who are obliged to travel for safe abortion services every day. And finally, the last person I'd like to introduce is Dr. Rona O'Mahony, who has kindly agreed to chair the seminar this evening. For most people here, I think Dr. O'Mahony needs no introduction. She's the master of the National Maternity Hospital, where she oversees more than 9,000 deliveries every year. In IFPA's circles, she's celebrated for her stigma-busting presentation to the Oireachtas Healthcare Committee during the hearings on the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Bill. And I've just found out this evening that Dr. Mahoney actually worked in for the IFPA in Carlbrew Street at one time. So before I just hand over to Dr. Mahoney, I would like to remind everybody that you're welcome to stay for a glass of wine at the end, and some finger food if you'd like to continue the discussion after the seminar. So thank you. To you.
Niall, thank you very much, and my thanks also to the IFPA for the invitation to come here this evening and for the invitation to take part in this conversation. You will have heard me speak before on the whole issue of our current situation in relation to termination of pregnancy, and particularly women's health. And as a medical profession and as a practitioner in the area of fetal and maternal medicine, we have many challenges faced for our patients that we see in our daily practice. And the three particular areas are the need for a woman to be dying to avail of a termination of pregnancy. And we also see in the context of fetal anomaly, where there is expectation of very short life after birth, that there is very little choice for families in how they navigate that very difficult situation. And we also saw the extension, I suppose, of the Eighth Amendment in terms of the dead woman who was effectively kept somatically alive so that we could incubate a fetus. And these are all things that have happened. This case happened in our country very recently. And so we see the challenges that are there for women who are ill and who have particular requirements. And my difficulty is that clinical decision-making is distorted by our current constitution, and at the same time, our constitution protects women who travel outside of our country in a reasonable irony to obtain termination of pregnancy. And we know that Irish women travel every day from our country to obtain termination of pregnancy, even in the most difficult of circumstances where their health or their baby's health is deeply affected. At the end of the day, it is about looking after women as best we can. It is about providing clear clinical and compassionate care so that we can give women the best care and that we can protect their health and indeed protect their life. The primary consideration should be clinical, it should not be legal. But sometimes we find that our clinical decision making is significantly distorted, and that's not a good thing. I don't know what will happen if an amendment was put to the people. I don't know what the outcome of that would be, but I think it's very wise for us to consider what would happen if the Eighth Amendment was repealed and how would we navigate the challenges that come. There is no law that's going to take away clinical complexity or the complexity of our lives or the difficult decisions that face women in all of their unique and different circumstances. Sometimes I think Ireland would love if life was black and white, but it isn't. And we meet so many women in such difficult circumstance, and at the end of the day, the best we can do is endeavour to provide them with the best possible care that will keep them body and soul together in a compassionate way. And I'm not sure at the moment we're always able to discharge that duty to women and children in our country. So I'm delighted this evening that we're going to have a conversation on what Ireland would look like if the Eighth Amendment was repealed and how we would navigate that. We have a really incredible panel, and I am really interested in what will be said this evening, but I think we are going to receive a very sophisticated, a very nuanced and a really good opinion based on such great experience, and I think it'll be a great privilege actually to hear from the speakers tonight. So if I could just introduce, just in order, Katrina Henschen. Katrina, known to me from the IFPA, but an experienced professional, and she's worked as medical director of the IFPA over 8 years, and she heads up the IFPA's post-abortion services and obviously has extensive experience of women's need, indeed, and women's experience in this context. Just next, we have Professor Emeritus Sir Sabharwal Arulkumaran. And Professor Arulkumaran was chair of a panel of inquiry into the death of Savita Halappanavar. That's how most of you in this country will know him. But of course, as an obstetrician gynecologist, I know him because he's been a previous president of the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and indeed has extensive experience of obstetrics and gynecology over many years. He's also been president of the International Federation of Gynecology and Obstetrics and of the British Medical Association. So it's just wonderful to have the opportunity to draw on his experience this evening. And last but not least, Professor Emerita Rebecca Cook, and it's wonderful to welcome you. Professor Cook is an expert on sexual and reproductive health and rights law. Professor Emerita and co-director of the International Reproductive and Sexual Health Law Programme at the University of Toronto. She also acts as an ethical and legal advisors and co-editor of the International Journal of Gynecology and Obstetrics and the official publication of FIGO. So I think this evening we really are blessed with a very experienced panel. And as I said, I really look forward to our conversation. Afterwards, I hope that we will have some questions from the audience, if that's okay with our speakers. And let's just have a really good conversation. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to this evening's event. I'm very, very honoured to be part of such a distinguished panel. It's not very often that you get to speak in such distinguished company. What I'm going to do, I suppose, is just give a brief snapshot of what it's like currently working as a health professional in Ireland under the current system. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about as such is what abortion law in Ireland and how it impacts on healthcare providers looking after women. So just to start, I suppose, with the Eighth Amendment, I think people could be forgiven for thinking that abortion somehow was legal in Ireland before the Eighth Amendment. Of course, it wasn't, and it wouldn't be legal if it was repealed. The point of the Eighth Amendment, the reason it was put in there, was to prevent the legislature from changing the legal state of abortion without having to go to the people first. So this amendment was passed by a referendum of the people in 1983, stating that the state acknowledges the right to life of the unborn and, with due regard to the equal right to life of the mother, guarantees in its laws to respect and, as far as practical by its laws, to vindicate that right. Now, at the time this wording was produced, it was felt that it was, in fact, going to be problematic and going to be ambiguous. And indeed, that proved to be the point, the case. So the first problem that really brought this to the public attention was the X case in 1992, in which the High Court granted an injunction to restrain Ms. X, who was a suicidal 14-year-old girl pregnant as a result of rape, from travelling to the UK for a termination. The judgment was appealed to the Supreme Court and was overturned on the basis that Ms. X's equal right to life entitled her to have an abortion in Ireland. So at that point, a precedent was set basically to say that a woman whose life was in danger was entitled to an abortion in Ireland, but there was no system put in place for any woman to actually exercise that right. Ultimately, it took more than 20 years before eventually the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Act was passed in 2014, which set out to clarify the circumstances in which a termination of pregnancy is legal in Ireland, which is when there is a real and substantial risk to the life of the pregnant woman. It also set out a system to establish this legal entitlement, including a review system. The Medical Council Guidelines' most recent update in 2016 largely reflects the wording of the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Act in relation to abortion. So there was fears that this was somehow going to open some sort of floodgates and there was going to be lots and lots and lots of terminations, but under the legislation, a report has to be made each year outlining the number of abortions carried out under the Act and whether they were carried out for emergency, as a result of physical illness posing a threat to life, or as a result of suicide posing a threat to life. And those are the figures for 2014 and 2015. So total of 26 in each year, and identical in terms of the breakdown also. In each year, only one case proceeded to review. In other words, only one woman who had initially been refused a termination actually went through the review process all the way to actually ask for a second opinion. In 2014, the case presented for review was deemed not to meet the criteria for a termination, so the woman was not granted the right to a termination. In 2015, the one case that proceeded through was found to meet the criteria, and the woman on review did actually qualify for a termination. So what are the difficulties with the Act? There's a number of things. I mean, I suppose, first of all, because it's new and because there's a lot of detail in it, access is going to be difficult because, number one, women aren't really aware or certain whether or not they might or might not qualify for a termination under the Act, and they may be reluctant to ask if they feel that, in fact, they don't qualify. Healthcare professionals, doctors, really aren't sure what would or would not qualify, and where there's that level of uncertainty and they're saying to somebody, well, I think you might actually qualify, and then they're not quite sure how to get them assessed quickly, and they're aware that if there's a delay or if the outcome is that they're deemed not to qualify, they will have delayed that woman's opportunity to actually access an abortion elsewhere. The guidelines predominantly deal with the actual certification process, what the qualifications of the person have to be, how many people are required for each type of certification, rather than actually, for example, providing guidance on what level of risk to the person's life does there have to be in order for them to qualify, what kind of conditions would be deemed to be a threat to somebody's life. And on that, I think that the lack of the woman's say in it is quite dramatic, because if you had somebody who was going to have any other procedure and you outlined for them what the risk was, it would be then up to them to decide, is that risk acceptable to me or not? In this situation, we're very much saying the doctors are deciding that the risk is not sufficient, so now we are saying you don't have the choice to make that decision yourself. The review system is quite difficult. And I mean, I think if you bear in mind that these women are ill, because they must be, their life must be in danger in order for them to be actually even considered. So they're sick women. Quite often the women who end up in this process may have other difficulties, whether they be educational, social, language, lots of other issues. The review must be in writing, and they must obviously try to do it within a reasonable time frame. I think the fact that only one review went through from start to finish each year kind of speaks for itself. And then obviously, as I said before, if whatever the way they go through the process, if the outcome is that they do not qualify for a termination, now as a number of weeks have passed since their original decision and they still have got no closer to having it. And obviously, from the general point of view, when we think of, okay, 26 terminations each year under this law, about 10 women per day leaving the country to have an abortion, this simply doesn't apply at all to the majority of women who want to have a termination. So what are these women's options, these other women? They either travel to another state, or they may avail of medical abortion online services, risking prosecution. They may, we don't know, potentially turn to abortion from other sources, obviously, again, illegal, or in an awful lot of cases, they continue with pregnancy they don't wish to continue with. So if they decide to travel abroad, what restrictions do we have? Okay, so a woman who wishes to travel abroad and wants to find out about services that are good, reputable services in another country, the getting of that information is controlled by the Regulation of Information Act, which was passed in 1995. So this basically sets out conditions under which information about legal abortion services in other countries can be given to women. So it must not promote or advocate for abortion. It must include information on all the courses of action open to a woman in her particular circumstances. And of the most concern, I think, referrals cannot be given or appointments made. Now, the Act goes on to state that this in no way prohibits a patient's right to their medical records or documents. But the difficulties with this. So the other provision is that the information must be given directly to the woman. So this prohibits, for example, the IFPA having a section on their website with names and addresses of good clinics that somebody could just access. That's simply not allowed. So a woman must know before, and let's remember, before somebody has a crisis pregnancy, they've never thought about any of this. They've never thought about what they might or might not do. So in that situation with time constraints, they have to be aware that there are pregnancy counselling services available that they can look up and find somebody to give them this information. They must be able to attend somebody to give them the information, and that person is then obliged to give them information that they haven't asked for. They're obliged to tell them that they could potentially either go on to parent or consider adoption, even if the person's first statement is, I've thought about everything and I can't go on with this pregnancy, I want to have a termination. So again, it's just this not actually accepting the woman's autonomy or her ability to have actually come to a reasoned decision by herself. And then there's the instance with the referrals. So there's definitely, and I would have come across cases where somebody has medical conditions, and I'm not necessarily talking about life-threatening conditions, but for example, somebody who's had previous blood clots and they're now on anticoagulants, and they're saying that they're going to travel for a termination. And if that person was traveling or going within the state for any other medical condition, I would make sure that a referral letter and a contact was made so that any surgeon that was going to perform a procedure on them would be aware that they had a risk of clots and that they were potentially a bleeding risk. But in this case, I'm relying on her to say, you need to tell them this, it's very important, and I can give you a letter and you can take it with them to say, and I have to come up with some wording that says, this woman might come to see you, and if she does, this is her medical history, rather than actually ensuring that that information gets to the person who needs to get it. The other problem with it is that if that woman arrives at a clinic, it may turn out that because of this medical condition, they will say, we can't actually see you in this clinic, you need to be referred to a hospital. The hospital isn't actually taking anybody today. you're going to have to go home and come back next week. And if that woman hasn't got enough money to go home and come back next week, that's her opportunity gone. But again, we can't actually refer her to the correct place in the first instance. So I think that's just totally unacceptable level of medical care. It wouldn't be accepted in any other aspect, so it shouldn't be accepted in this case. So then a lot of women are using medical abortion online services for very good reasons. Economically, it makes huge sense. It's much, much cheaper. And they don't have to worry about not only the cost, but trying to get out of the country without anybody knowing why they're gone, trying to find somebody to mind their kids, pick them up from school or whatever, without being able to explain why they're not around. So a lot of women are doing this, and the vast majority of them have a very safe experience. The problem is, of course, that they don't really have any backup if something does go wrong, or even if they think something might have gone wrong. So, a lot, you know, at some of the services, they will be able to email somebody if they have a question, but you can imagine if that's during the night, they're going to wait several hours for an answer. And my experience, certainly, of the very small number of women I see, because as I said, you don't see very many of them, most of them aren't going to come to see the doctor, but if they do, they've delayed coming because they weren't sure what was going to happen. They are aware that they've broken the law and they're afraid that there might somehow be some rule that says that you're going to have to report them. So it's definitely deterring women from seeking help. The other thing is that any obstetrician will tell you that anybody who is pregnant, frequently their estimate of how far pregnant they are is inaccurate. And medical terminations are going to be less likely to be successful if they have exceeded the gestation. So you're going to have this increased risk of failure, and quite often the woman may not realise that the procedure has failed because she may have had some bleeding. She's not really sure what to expect, so she thinks everything has proceeded, and it's only a few weeks later that she realises she's still pregnant. A pregnancy test is still going to be positive for a few weeks, so that's actually no help to her. She can't do a test to check. So if she's not getting followed up by somebody, she's not going to know until a few weeks later. So again, she's got more time delay gone on there. But also, if now she's not able to travel, she's actually been, her fetus has been exposed to potentially teratogenic medicine. That's medicine that could cause harmful effects. So this is, again, what I would say is, for the women who actually avail of this and everything goes well, they will say it was a blessing for them that that was available. But that's a completely unacceptable low level of standard of care for anybody. So in conclusion, my point really, I suppose, overall, is that access to abortion in Ireland is largely dependent on a woman's resources. And that's financial resources, educational level, ability to speak English, and support of family and friends. And without any one of those things, their access may simply not exist. And I think that's clearly an inequality that's inconsistent with any sort of international human rights standards. So thank you.